Welcome to the Collide Podcast. We're a growing community of everyday chicks colliding with Jesus in our mess, our pain, our joy, and our stories. We value showing up as we truly are, so that's what you'll find here. Walls and masks being torn down so that we can allow Jesus to meet us where we truly are and hear about other women doing the same. We can't wait to collide with you.
I needed to define what a healthy boundary was for allowing this person who had a history of hurting me into my heart and into my life. And my fear of new hurt was based off of a track record of old hurt. So I needed to create a space where not only was I open to reconciliation, but I was protected from new hurt.
Hey guys, welcome to the We Collide Podcast. I'm so glad that you hopped on today. I'm Willow Weston, the founder and director of Collide, and I'm super excited to have Fred Hartsook on the podcast today. I've known Fred since he was a freshman in college, which is almost 20 years ago, and every time Fred and I get together, we have the best conversation, so I'm super excited to have this one. Fred is currently the business development manager at Faith Life and director of the Garden of College Age Ministry in Bellingham, Washington. He is married to Celeste, and they have a sweet little guy named Felix. Fred loves to smoke meat. He loves connecting with people, and he's so good at connecting people to people. He loves to have deep chats, and so today we're going to have one. Fred, thank you so much for hanging out with me on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to dive right in, and we're going to dive into family pain and family dysfunction and mess and wounds and reconciliation. And I know this is all the fun stuff, right? But hey, can you tell us how old is Felix, and how did having Felix sort of bring up in you as you became a dad stuff from your family of origin?
Yeah, Felix is just over 7 months now, and he came along. We were 5.5 years married when he was born, and Felix came along after quite a few years of not only working through things with my wife Celeste. After 10 weeks into our marriage, she lost her mom, and so there was just the first couple of years of our marriage were really marked by grieving and really having her world turned upside down in that way. But all that, of course, was coming in conjunction with my own story having to be dismantled and put back together again as a result of getting married. And with Felix coming along, when you get pregnant, you know, people ask you, are you hoping for a boy or a girl? And it's one of the silliest questions that we ask prospective parents, because every parent's answer is the same, which is that if it's healthy, I'm fine. But we all really do have a preference though, right? So Celeste and I both were leaning to like, man, it'd be a lot easier if we just had a girl. For one thing, she was one of two sisters, and I, because of my relationship with my dad growing up, I had incredible insecurity about being a father to a son. And so because of how my father failed me, I was so anxious about the idea of setting myself up to fail a son the way that my father failed me. So I was really hoping, well, let's just have a daughter and I'll certainly not have any of those problems. And so when we went to the 20-week ultrasound and saw that it was a boy, literally in that ultrasound tech room, I had probably a 3-minute somewhat of a panic attack. And it literally was a flood of adrenaline and memories of all this different stuff from childhood that was marked by my dad and I's dysfunctional relationship. And I had to just sit in that for those 3 minutes while my wife is very excited and the tech is talking to us about things. And I was speechless, and I didn't know what to feel. And I just knew that that God was either playing some great big practical joke on me, or he had some master plan. And a lot of the times it feels like both at the same time. And then in the second half of our pregnancy, as we were waiting for Felix to come, it really felt so much like the Lord is not just, he's not going to bring me a son so that I can heal all my wounds through parenting a son, but he is bringing me a son to that will be a byproduct of having a son, is that I'm going to have to do some real hard work of healing and letting God speak into that story.
Fred, first of all, I love your honesty. I love having a conversation with a man who is just lays it out there and says, I had insecurities about being a father to a son. Like, I just love your honesty and vulnerability in that. And I'm just wondering if you can kind of take us back. You say your father failed you. Like, can you invite us into what that looks like so that we understand how that insecurity formed in you and what that felt like in that room when you found out you were having a son?
Sure. I was, so big part of my story, I was adopted from South Korea. I was adopted at 21 months, Christmas Eve, 1986. I always like to say that I was the ultimate stocking stuffer. And whenever I'm speaking at church or something, all of the women of my parents' age and older just like die laughing. But anyway, I was adopted.
So this is, you're cueing me. I'm supposed to be dying laughing right now.
You're
not
my parents' age, Willow.
Okay.
Anyhow, so so I was adopted into a family of two parents and an older sister who was also adopted. She was adopted from Tacoma, Washington, though, so it wasn't that far from where I grew up. I was the exotic baby, shall we say? But
very
exotic. So my parents, I always like to put it this way, because I don't have ill feelings toward them, and I don't ever want to publicly villainize them in any way. But they really, truly, I believe, were good people who were not good parents. And my mom, for very different reasons, but my dad was incredibly wounded from his own upbringing, his own experiences, his own dysfunctional relationships with his parents. And so he ended up being a little bit of the classic that a lot of people understand of sort of physically present and emotionally absent. He had a bit of that, but he also had this sort of strange sort of victim or emotional martyr mentality that prevented him from being able to have real authentic relationship, because he never had any ownership or responsibility over how his actions made other people feel. So when you are his kid and you make a mistake, or you hurt your kid in some way, which we all inevitably do, and you make your kid feel like it was their fault, that cycle, eventually something has to give. So I think my sister and I caught on fairly early. My mom died when I was just about to turn 11. And so from that point on, there was no veil behind his parenting and behind his lack of health that he was bringing in. My story of growing up with my dad was a lot of feelings of broken promises, a lot of feelings of good intentions, but bad execution, and feeling like my dad, I always point out, you know, my dad spent probably three nights a week in parenting classes or at parenting counseling. And all of those nights of the week, I was just home alone by myself wondering where my dad was. So the irony is that if he would have just come home and had dinner with me, we probably would have had a pretty decent relationship. But there was some sort of broken part of his thinking, it resulted in young adulthood. He got remarried. In my young adulthood, I should say, he was old. He got remarried, and his new wife brought a lot of toxicity into our family, and it resulted in, when I was, I think, 23 years old, I just created a full break in our relationship. And I just said, I need to not be contacted by you anymore. And up to the point that, you know, like when I was sitting in the room 11 years later, finding out that I was having a son, I still had not spoken to my dad since that point. So everyone, I think, who has kind of a weird relationship or even a bad relationship with their parent thinks that they have the worst or the weirdest. Then we come into contact with other people and we find out that everybody's got something. The uniqueness of my dad and I's relationship, I think, really is marked by the onus for owning the emotional and relational health of the father-son dynamic was put back onto the son. And that, as the foundation of the relationship, just created nothing but unhealthy patterns and other dynamics in the relationship. So that made me very nervous to feel like I don't know if I'm any better equipped to have a healthy relationship with a son, because I don't want a parent out of just wanting to do the inverse of what my dad did. But nevertheless, I know that there was real conditioning that happened in me that that I was really afraid of bringing into a new child.
I have so many questions I want to ask you, Fred. So tell us a little bit about what it's like to vacillate between, I mean, I'm assuming you were adopted by this man. I'm assuming there's a part of you that feels like you should feel so grateful for that. And on one hand, maybe you do, but on the other hand, all the broken promises and intentions without execution were so hurtful. How did you sort of, and how do you live in that tension of like being grateful for some parts of who he is and very deeply wounded by other parts?
You know, that's a really good, that's a really good question, because it's unique to a subsegment of people. Those of us who've been adopted and have not been adopted into the best of families. I think I focused really heavily on this when I was in counseling, when I was in college, because my counselor was just amazing at letting my story just be my story and just letting everything be on the table and just looking at it. And this was a big part that I hadn't looked at yet, which was what part of my story is written by that unique part of it. And I grew up around a lot of other adopted kids, or maybe I just noticed because I was adopted, and it's like if you buy a Mini Cooper, all of a sudden you see only other Mini Coopers on the street. And maybe there weren't that many adopted kids around me, but somehow I knew them. But a lot that we had the whole gamut of experiences, you know, people who were so, they felt like there was this gaping hole in their soul over the question of why was I put up for adoption and didn't my parents want me and any of that stuff. And then there's these the whole wide other end of the spectrum of people who were so incredibly grateful that their adopted parents would pray for them, would seek them out, would welcome them, would treat them just as they view that they are treating their biological kids. And I was somewhere close to apathetic in between all that growing up. I think I didn't have much of a, I wasn't very grateful. but I also wasn't resentful or questioning. I think I just sort of like took it for what it was. And I knew enough of the background of my biological parents to know, like, yeah, I probably have it better over here, even if my parents are kind of, you know, kind of ill-equipped to do this. My parents had a really difficult time getting pregnant, ended up using some pretty, what we would probably consider now, fairly archaic methods of getting pregnant in the 70s, had a baby. That baby died of SIDS before she was 2 years old. And shortly thereafter, they adopted my sister through an acquaintance of an acquaintance, because that's how you could do things in the 80s. And then a few years later, wanted another child, and it was on trend to go get one from Asia. So here I am.
You're so trendy and exotic.
You know what? Hey, absolutely.
You mentioned that your mom died before your 11th birthday.
That's right.
What did it look like for you to grieve your mom when you were 11 years old?
Let me tell you this. The day that she died, she had ovarian cancer, and she lived with it for, I believe, 2.5 years or so. Did all, you know, chemo and other treatment and everything. She died. She was in hospice care in our house, and I remember the night that she was admitted to the hospital. She died the next morning. And that day, I was the last to be told. I wasn't the last to know, but I was the last to be told. Everybody went to the hospital except for me and my grandpa, and to say goodbye. And then I got put over at a family friend's house, who I had a play date scheduled with anyway, but they still took me over there. I knew that my mom had died, but they still took me over there, and my dad came and picked me up a few hours later. And when we got home, he looked to me to comfort him in his loss. And so as I was 10 years, 11 months, I remember vividly him breaking down crying on the couch in our living room, and me walking over and like holding him next to me and letting him cry. And so I think my opportunity to grieve my mom really got hijacked in that space. And I don't think I really did go through much of a real grieving process until I was in counseling probably 10 years later. And again, my counselor just kind of put it on the table and just let me know, like, hey, this is still here. And we're going to have to look at this.
It's so interesting how that stuff does not go away. You know, it comes back to bite you. I just had this in a way this week, but it's so interesting to me when you share, because you were a kid who had to be the adult and take care of the adult who was acting like a kid. Mm-hmm. And that can create so much bitterness when you finally wake up and see it for what it is.
Absolutely.
When you finally wake up years later, you can't see it when you're 11. You're just fulfilling a duty that you feel loyal to this person to fulfill. But then a decade or two later, you wake up and you're like, I deserved as an 11-year-old for my parent to help me grieve, but instead they relied on me to help them grieve. And it's so maddening that you had to be put in that position. How are you moving through that kind of bitterness? I mean, you talk about at 23 years old, you cut your dad off. At 33, you found yourself in a room finding out that you were having a boy, and all this insecurity flooded you, and you had this panic attack. How are you moving through the frustration and the bitterness and the anger?
Yeah, it really reached a head in my early 20s, and part of it was an outcome of the great counseling that I was in, and you know, sitting with my counselor and seeing all the things on the table and saying, yeah, that was just life. It's fine. It's just life. And having my counselor sit across from me and cry and say, no, Fred, you were a kid. That wasn't fair. That wasn't right. And to really fully, for the first time, let myself feel that hurt in my early 20s, it brought every emotion with it. It brought the why questions. It brought a lot of really difficult, unanswerable questions that I had to bring to the Lord too, about, well, your promises that I know of to me are one thing, but yet my life experience has been very different as a result of the parents that you gave me. And so that was a whole other thing to tackle. But in the time where I needed to create distance between my dad and I, it was full on. I was my dad's emotional support. I was his counselor. I was his pastor in many ways. I was his sounding board for so many of the, dysfunctional things he was finding in his own life and proclivities that he participated in. And it got to the point where I had a stress ulcer and was depressed and could barely function in my own life. And that clued me in that I needed to hit the release valve. And probably for about 3 to 5 years after severing that with my dad, I had, that was really the height of the journey of dealing with the pain and allowing myself to be angry, but then allowing myself to move past the anger and find what the hurt was that was underneath, and really try to find forgiveness in there and try to find healing in there. You know, whatever you want to call it, phrases or whatever about how forgiveness is really about the forgiver and the change in their heart. I really feel like I experienced that, you know, once I was able to take an inventory, so to speak, of what was bottled up in my heart that I was hurt about and that I was resentful or bitter about. Then I found that I was the one who was being held down and being imprisoned by those feelings. And so my dad, it hurt him to not have his son in his life, but he wasn't experiencing the same hurt that I was. We were going through different things. And so a lot of it had to do with I sought out whatever kind of, I don't know exactly how I felt about prayer back then, but I tried it. And I sought out people who could speak into my life, and particularly people who had had relationships with their parents that weren't easy. You were one of those people, and there were multiple others. That served in many ways to be a guide for me, but it also gave it, the primary thing that it gave me was a little bit of hope that that I could function as a healthy adult. That these people that I saw who were carrying massive scarring from their parents were in marriages that were working and were raising kids who were awesome and living out their callings in whatever ways. And I saw that and I said, okay, it's worth trying then. So those first 5 years were really just, was really just letting myself feel all the things that I had shoved way down in the first 23. And in the second 5 or 6 years, without speaking to my dad, it was, I feel like the work of forgiveness had been passed. I think out of fear of new resentment or new hurt, I ended up being pretty stumped and kind of frozen in any thoughts of how do I repair this relationship and how do I get back into it, because I was just too afraid of repeating history. And I don't think that was necessarily old resentment. I think it was fear of new resentment.
There's so much good stuff in here, but I think a few things that I want to draw out and kind of talk about a little bit more. One is, and I found it to be true for my own life, that there's so much power in naming what we needed that we didn't get. And it's hard to do that. But once you can sit in a room with a counselor, sit in a room with God, or sit in a room with a friend and say, I was supposed to have a dad who was there for me, and I didn't have that. Once you can say that, there's actually so much power in that, which sounds almost like, oh, so basically we just have to have a pity party for ourselves. But I think that's kind of the work of grieving, and grieving is recognizing a loss. And if we don't grieve and we're trying to skip right over to the healing part without grieving, we won't get there because we haven't grieved yet. And part of grieving is saying, I was supposed to have something. I was intended to have it and I didn't have it.
Absolutely.
Do you find, like, when you look back on your process and you think about the people listening right now who they just want peace in their relationships. They just want healing, but they've skipped over that grieving part. I mean, what's your advice for them?
Well, I mean, I think there are things that we know to be true that are sometimes helpful to be reminded of and sometimes are can frustrate us. Like, you know, there really is no shortcut. There's no quick bypass to this process. And there's also no template. There is not a, here's five steps to releasing and reconciling the hurts of your childhood. You know, the plenty of books have been sold that have models that might work for some, but for each of us, because of the uniqueness of our stories, the one of the things that I find when I am speaking with young people who are just for the first time being confronted with the reality that they didn't have something that they needed as they were growing up, the thing that always ends up being a part of the conversation is you have to give yourself permission to be sad. And you have to give yourself permission to not know even the depth of your hurt until the Lord speaks to you and says that this is it. It's all on the table now. And you have to give yourself permission to, you know, my counselor used the example of just open every single door in your past. And it doesn't, and some of the doors are really fun to open and some of them are really scary because it's dark in there and you don't know what all you're going to find or what could surprise you. But more than having, or not more, but along with having the courage to go into those spaces, you have to give yourself permission to do it, because we can come up with any number of reasons why it's inconvenient for us right now, or it would be a burden to the people closest to us if we used up our emotional bandwidth on ourselves. Whatever it is, we have to give ourselves our own permission to go into those spaces, to open all of those doors and to see what's there, and then to deal with it, whatever comes back out on the table. I find that to be a common thread, that we really struggle to give ourselves that permission. And it's if we never do it, if we allow others to determine our readiness and our availability for working through these real parts of our story, then we're never going to plumb all of the depths of it, because it's always going to be on someone else's terms who can't possibly know what it felt like to live in those moments that we lived in. Only we know those things. So I really feel that the permission aspect is one that I would really hope that people would explore and take to heart, and say, what does it look like on an emotional bandwidth level, but also just logistically, you know, do I need to change my budget so that I can afford to pay somebody for a designated space to work this stuff out with me? Do I need to plan my day differently because I know that as I go into these things, my ability to help others is going to be rearranged throughout the course of how I manage my own day? Whatever that may look like, that's all a part of giving yourself permission to open all those doors and to find whatever is in there, and to let yourself be hurt by it, and then let yourself be healed in that same process.
The image of opening all the doors, I mean, it takes incredible courage to open any door from our past. And part of it is as you were talking, I was thinking, oh my gosh, because if we don't open the doors and look at what's in all of those rooms, we become hoarders of pain, right? It's kind of like when you don't clean out your closets and your pantries and your linen closet, all of those things, and like take out the stuff you don't need and clean them up and keep them organized, like you become a hoarder. And I think it's so hard to open those doors because it hurt the first time. So like, yeah, open it back up and experience what I call re-injury is sometimes even worse. And yet, if we don't open the doors of our pain and allow God into those spaces to heal them, we never actually get to the wholeness and peace that we desire. We're trying to fast forward our brokenness, is what I like to say, and get to wholeness. Mm-hmm. But Jesus actually invites us to stand in our pain and our brokenness, and he meets us there. And I think so often we've even been taught, experience something hard, like close the door, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, move on. What's the past is the past, you know, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work to just shut all the pain behind a door and try to move on. It's kind of like sweeping everything under the rug. I like to say it starts to not look like a rug. It starts to look like, there's all this stuff piled up layer upon layer upon layer, and no longer looks like a rug. Another thing that you brought up, which is I think so many of us can resonate with, is when you have been hurt by your own family and then you think about having a family of your own, it is so helpful to go and see and talk and learn from other people who give you hope that a different story is possible. How did you seek those people out in your own life so that you were able to see that it's possible to live a different story than the one you experienced?
You know, on the one hand, I'd like to take credit for seeking out those people and finding them and being very intentional. And in some cases, that was the case. But in others, and I'd say maybe even many of them, it just happened to be that our lives overlapped, and I was, I've been saying a lot lately that God knows what we need before we know to ask for it. And so he puts people strategically in our lives, and is just kind of turns the lights on and is like, here you go. I mean, come on, dummy. And so the fact that I was working at a coffee shop that you came to very, very frequently, and
don't call me out on my coffee addiction, Fred.
You know, this was years ago.
Okay.
Also, it's still happening. But anyway, at just different coffee shops now. Anyway, I was working there, and you were there often, writing or working on messages or whatever it was, and your kids were very young, and you were so gracious to me when I was taking my breaks to invite me over to just chat. And in those 10 or 30 minute segments, we would somehow go from saying hi to all of the deep garbage that's been in our lives. I would always leave with this sort of mix of feeling like, yes, I have this weight that I have to carry that was put on me unfairly in my life, but I also have this encouragement from this person who knows what it's like to carry a weight like this, that that I can do it, and that the weight can become less, and that I can be free from it, and that I needed to trust the Lord, and I needed to allow myself to do it. And so, you know, I don't believe that that was any accident that you happen to live close to that coffee shop when I was working there. And there are several others who in my life, I think, were put there. And all I needed to do was be aware that they were there, and then I could have those great conversations. But truly, it does take the, you know, some of those things can happen magically here or there, but once you realize that that dynamic is available in a relationship, you have to do the real work of showing up and knocking on the door, and just like, don't bury the lead. Just go ahead and ask, hey, look, I got this thing, you've got that thing. Could I ask you about it a little bit? Could I bounce a few things off you? Would you have space for that? And I think any of us who are traveling on that road will do our very best to create that space for others who are finding their way onto the road with us.
You mentioned that you had kind of worked yourself to a place of forgiveness, but were kind of afraid to get hurt again, which I think is a common experience we have when we're continuing to be in relationship with people who wounded us, but we don't necessarily trust them. what did it look like for you to move from a place of forgiveness to a place of actually desiring reconciliation? Because forgiveness and reconciliation are completely different from one another. And of course, one can kind of lead into the next. But as you stood in this room while your wife celebrated having a son, all of your sort of wounds from your father were coming up in you. What happened that invited you into stepping into a reconciliation process with your dad?
Yeah, you know, when I moved out of my dad's house, I was 16 years old, and I moved in with my aunt and uncle, who is my aunt is my dad's sister. And that was necessary to get me to have some structure in my life to be able to finish high school. But what it also did was a byproduct of that was getting to see my dad through a different perspective and getting to see more of his story. My aunt and uncle became like, you know, bonus parents in some ways. I became very close with them. And when I severed things with my dad, they became the ones that I would go to holidays, and I would, they were the ones who I would call when you got to check in with family. And, it really, really affected my aunt to have her brother and her nephew, estranged. And I would like to say that I had some sort of humble and mature and enlightening experience that let me know I needed to reconcile. But it was really through the pain of my aunt that created a sense of urgency when I was ready. And because of just how much stress it put on her to have us be apart. And she knew that I had done what I needed to do the work that needed to be done in my heart had been done enough anyway, to the point where I could conceivably reconcile with my dad and try to create a healthy boundary for him in my life. But that carried on still for a few more years. And it was a constant, back and forth between, I really want to do this. There's nothing holding me back anymore. My heart is I have a clean slate in some ways. I feel like I'm not carrying baggage into what would be a new type of relationship with him. I am afraid of getting hurt again, but I also feel strong enough to hold up a boundary. But I was stumped. You know, he lives about 120 miles from here, and I said, what do? Just call him randomly and say, hey, will you meet me at some restaurant in Seattle? You know, I all of those things probably would have been fine. It never felt right. And I couldn't tell you why that is, but I ended up the last couple of years having a lot of, my burden then was about, okay, now at this point, because of what's gone on in my heart, now the cruelty is on my side by not reaching out. And letting my dad believe that his son doesn't want anything to do with him, or that his son doesn't care about him. And those things simply weren't true, but he had no way of knowing that because I had not come around to the point where I was willing to give him a call. I knew that my dad's a little bit older, and I knew that there were some chronic health issues going on in his life. And so I knew that there were a lot of different possibilities for how we could get together, or possibly I could miss the opportunity if he had a heart attack or something. And I really feared that happening. And it was late August of this last year. Felix was due early September. And throughout our pregnancy, I really felt a heightened sense of urgency around, I want my dad to be able to know Felix, and I want Felix to be able to know his grandpa, and I don't want to rob them of that relationship because I was too chicken or I was too afraid or whatever, because I'm ready. But nevertheless, I still didn't know how to do it. And so in late August, I got a call at 4 in the morning from my sister that my dad was in the hospital with, looked like he'd had a stroke or possibly multiple strokes, and that she was going to be on her way over. She lives across the state, and she was getting in the car and driving over, and that if possible, I might want to think about getting in the car and driving down. So I was a little bit frozen in the moment. Again, I knew that this was one of the possible ways that this could happen, but you know, the reality of it just sort of had to sink in. But eventually I woke Celeste up and we started driving. We were planning to be out of town for the weekend anyway, so it was it wasn't highly disruptive in that way, but as we're getting close, my sister calls again and says, "Hey, if you guys were thinking about stopping for lunch or something like that, like, don't, because it doesn't look good over here." And so we kept driving, and Celeste was so great. She, when she knows that there's something heavy on me, that, she doesn't push me, to process the emotions any faster than they're already going. So, but she checked in with me a couple of times as we were driving and said, you know, "How are you doing? How are you feeling?" And I was truthful and just surprised by, like, you know what? I'm completely peaceful about this. I have no idea what's about to happen. I don't know why things are happening the way they are, but I feel completely peaceful about it. And we pulled into the hospital, and we walked in, and we walked upstairs and walked into the room. My aunt and uncle were there. My sister and her family was there, and they took me back to my dad's room, to where his wife was. And my dad was super out of it. He had had 2 strokes in the last 18 hours. And I leaned down and I said hi, and he reached his arms up, and I gave him a hug. And that was the first time we'd seen each other on purpose in 11 years. And I was a little bit I guess sort of like, just, I don't know, adrenaline or so much adrenaline that I was calm, I guess. And I look up, and my aunt and my sister and my dad's wife are all crying, and I'm going, "Oh yeah, this wasn't just about me and my dad. This really affected everybody." And my dad and I sat in the room that night, and I cut him some slack because he had just had 2 strokes and he'd been up all night, but he was saying all of the things that a hurt person says in that situation. And fortunately, that peace never left me. And I was able to just kind of grab his hand and say, "Look, Dad, I mean, look where you are. And I'm really sorry that it came to this for us to be in the room together, but I'm really grateful that we're in the room together. And I want to continue being in the room with you. But look where you are, and look what just happened to you. And do you want to spend whatever time you got left, whether it's hours or years, do you want to spend it screwing around, kicking all this old junk down the road? Or do you want to be a grandpa? And do you want to let us get to know each other again? And do you want to get to know Celeste?" And he just cried, and he didn't say much. And we came back 2 days later, and we came up, and his wife stopped us on the elevator and said, "I don't know what's going on with this guy, but I've never seen him like this. So just a fair warning." And I'm going, "Oh no, what in the world are we walking into?" And I walk in the room, and my dad was sitting up, and he was giddy. Like, I have never seen my dad just giggling and like energetic, and like he had this like joie de vivre that I've never seen before. So talkative, so just like, he brought up multiple times, you know, I stood on death's door 2 days ago, and for some reason I got to come across to the other side here, and I want to make the most of it. And from that point, we have been in semi-regular contact. We took him out for his birthday. He's come up to see Felix right after Felix was born. It's been a I think I'm living in the story in real time. So I'm trying to do my best to be self-aware in the moment. But it really feels like the Lord knew what we needed before we knew to ask for it. I would never have asked the Lord to give my dad two strokes so that it would force me to go to the hospital. And I don't have bad enough theology to think that he gave my dad two strokes so that we would reconcile. But I know that that at least in my understanding of God, he doesn't let any of that go to waste. And so he took that terrible thing that happened to my dad and he used it to create an incredible moment and an incredible opportunity for he and I to sit in the same room and have the conversation we had needed to have for 11 years. And so now as I think I always would have been delighted to see my son, but now I think I feel a strange freedom that I wouldn't have known what it was, but I feel this freedom to love my son knowing that my dad and I have been reconciled and that I'm not carrying that anymore, at least not in nearly the same way. As I walk out from this room, I'll go and I'll pick up Felix and I'll look in his eyes and I'll just get to be delighted that I get to be his dad. And I don't have to have that lens over it of knowing that my dad and I are estranged, and I can love, I think, more fully and more freely than I would have otherwise.
Fred, I love that God has shown you that a different story for your own life is possible. And I love that in that moment in the hospital when you allowed God to sort of, it almost sounds like his spirit overcame you and gave you that peace he promises that transcend our understanding, almost like we don't even know where it comes from. Like, why were you so calm and able to just walk in there so gracefully and even with such strength be able to invite your dad and into something different as he started kind of bringing up old stuff? And I love that you gave him the gift and the hope that a different story between the both of you is possible. And your family members crying, I mean, that's such a beautiful picture of, it's so true that when we have brokenness in relationship with others, it breaks the whole village up. And they got to be a part of seeing this reconciliation story begin to take place. I just love your story, and I am excited to see what happens as you move forward. I'm wondering, as we kind of come to a close, I think my last question that I just want to ask you is, I think about people listening and they're hurting and they're not there yet and they haven't had that moment yet with the person who wounded them. And maybe the idea of forgiveness or reconciliation just feels so overwhelming and they have no idea where to start. What is your best advice on, here's some steps or places you could start to walk towards reconciliation in relationship with someone who hurt you?
Yeah, it's like you were mentioning earlier that that forgiveness and reconciliation are really, they're two different phases, at very least. Forgiveness is something we do internally or privately, and reconciliation involves relationships. So that, I don't know which one feels more challenging to anybody who's listening, but if anyone is feeling like, okay, maybe my heart has made this turn, and I'm not only maybe feeling like I'm responsible to initiate reconciliation, but the terminology that I use with my dad was, it was the longer I didn't reconcile, the more cruel it felt. Because I didn't want my dad to die feeling like his son didn't love him. I would recommend to anybody that the first, what was helpful for me was that I needed to define what a healthy boundary was for allowing this person who had a history of hurting me into my heart and into my life. And my fear of new hurt was based off of a track record of old hurt. So I needed to create a space where not only was I open to reconciliation, but I was protected from new hurt. And it doesn't have to be a boundary that gets set and that stays forever, but at least is one that is that you know you're okay with for now. Because as somebody maybe re-earns your trust or participates in reconciliatory work with you, then maybe the boundary can change. Or maybe you go in and you find that the person is going to continue hurting you if you expand your boundary anymore, then you know. Then it can stay where it is, or maybe it can change in a different direction. But whatever that looks like from an emotional, from a mental, from a logistical level, to be able to just name it, write it down, bounce it off of people who know you best. You know, one of the boundaries that I set with my dad was, you don't call me, I call you. And you can call me on my birthday and holidays, or if there's some emergency. But otherwise, I know that it will still, it will be stressful for me if my phone is ringing all the time and it's your name on the phone. So just for now, let me call you. And he was okay with that. And he's respected that. But that was a boundary that I knew that I needed. So I would say, take some time and really be honest with yourself. And, you know, I had a struggle with feeling like I was capable of more, capable of a bigger boundary, capable of being more open to having my dad in my space. And it was actually my sister, who, you know, she and I are not incredibly close, but she knows my dad and, we know each other fairly well. And, she had just said, no, actually, I want you to have a smaller boundary for him, because I know that you feel like you can do it, but you shouldn't have to. That's the thing. It should be, there should be some mutuality in this work, and you shouldn't have to jump back into to bearing the whole load of whatever nonsense comes up. So that was incredibly helpful, being able to call my sister and say, this is what I'm thinking, and have her say, no, you need to be safer than that. That was actually really good. For those who have a history of with an abusive relationship in family, I mean, obviously those lines will need to get drawn really, really thick, bold, Sharpie, all of that. And that's completely on your terms. And for those who have a situation more like mine, where it was more fuzzy and gray, then it's really probably going to have to be one that you name, and that you are constantly evaluating. But you know, all the great books about boundaries are great for a reason, because they're incredibly helpful and they give us really useful language. And I would say, do that work, name that, and then, bounce it off a couple of people who you really trust that know you and will speak honestly with you.
Well, Fred, I know we could talk for a very long time about a lot of things about life, but I'm grateful that you hopped on today and so openly shared about your story and the beautiful way that God is reconciling you with your father and giving you then this beautiful confidence to be a dad to Felix. It gives us so much encouragement in our own stories of woundedness. And I know that there'll be people who want to connect with you. How can people find you, Fred?
Well, all of my social media handles are really complicated. They're all the same, and it's just my name. So Fred Hartsook. I assume you'll put my name somewhere in the podcast information. So I'm on all the spaces, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm not on TikTok. I don't know how to dance, so I haven't done that. I'm also not a 12-year-old girl. But then my email is the same. It's just my name at gmail.com. And I would welcome anybody who wants to connect. I'd be glad to do that.
That's awesome. Thank you for hanging out. And for those of you listening, my hope for you is that you would hold on to the idea that a different story is possible for you, even when it feels like it's not, and that you would begin to take steps towards the hard work of reconciliation, because it truly is beautiful. I hope you have a great week, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks for tuning in. To keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram at we.collide, on Facebook as at We Collide Women, and you can also visit our website at wecollide.net to find our blog, resources, event information, and more. One last thing. If you enjoyed this episode, would you take a few seconds and leave us a review? It seems like such a small act, but reviews help us to keep producing this content and help other women find it too. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode and letting us walk with you as you seek and collide with Jesus.